welcome back to another exciting episode of Extra Features Interview. Today we have fabulous producer, director, David Charlton, his film Hunter. It's awesome. Please,
Carlton.
Everybody's... Carlton. See, I told you I'd screw it up anyway.
Sorry. Maybe we can do take two.
That's fine. I never edit. Everybody knows I screw up everybody's last name. They're used to it. So, are you filming in your hometown?
Yes. So I lived in the Chicago area, and Hunter was all shot in Chicago, in the depth of winter during the polar vortex. So it was crazy cold when we were shooting here. The wind chill was like -30, -35, something like that. It was pretty rough.
Let's start right there. Since you're going to bring it up, I was going to bring up snow later on. How is shooting in the cold? Like, I mean, you have a very low-budget crew. I'm sure you don't have heating areas already laid out. Maybe a van running all the time.
No, you have the right idea. Yeah, this was – we were low-budget on this. So what do we do? So, I kept keeping my fingers crossed that no one would get frostbite and lose a toe. But we had those little heating things for people's gloves and shoes and – wearing lots of socks and things, which helps a little. I mean, you know, that stuff helps, but with that cold, it's pretty tough. The biggest things we had was, you know, because we shot all of our exterior location stuff first so that we could get the snow and sort of, you know, the idea was always that it was going to be this kind of cool, wintry look. Although then Mother Nature gave us really extra cool winter look. But we always had cars running. That was usually sort of our go-to. And in fact, it was an issue with the camera. We were shooting with the Blackmagic pocket camera and the first generation of the Blackmagic cinema camera. And the pocket camera couldn't take the cold, like it would shut off. So we had, like on the really bad days, we would have to take it inside the car, which of course then fogs up the lens. And like it's hard in every way. So you take it in the car, the batteries would just go instantly. But then we'd take it out, shoot, hope that the lens unfog or whatever, and then she then has to go back in. So that was just on the really worst days that it was that bad. There was lots of days in my life like that. No, it was hard. I mean, it was pretty brutal out there. But it gives the film a really distinctive look because of, you know, of what the snow was able to give us.
Well, I thought it was just a weird choice. I mean, you don't see many indies shooting in mega cold weather, and I live in Toronto. I knew it was cold.
Right. Toronto, you have similar weather to us here. I think part of the idea was that the snow was a kind of way of visualizing Hunter's sort of internal journey. You know, for those of you who don't sort of know the story, Hunter's the story of a former mixed martial arts fighter who had this sort of horrific experience in his past and has ended up on the street with PTSD and sort of just trying to figure out what happened. And so the snow and the cold really helped with the sense of everything was out to get Hunter, you know, like the environment and just sort of a stark, gritty, textured landscape that he found himself in. So, it was always on in the script. I mean, that was always the plan. It's just when we actually got out there to shoot, we kept saying, you know, the next one we're going to shoot in Tahiti. Hunter finds himself, stranded on an island in Tahiti. And it was hard, but, you know, it gave it a really, you know, you're especially in a low-budget film, you're always trying to find ways to make the film be distinctive. And, you know, I can't compete with the Avengers. But you can do things to make the film be specific and different and sort of its own thing. That's a big piece of what's going on.
You seem to brought up the Avengers. I don't think you're making the Avengers. You're making a very different kind of film.
No. It's a thriller. You know, like if you have to pick a single genre for it to be in, it's a thriller. But it's very cross-genre. I mean, there's a lot of stuff happening in there.
I would say it was a horror.
And some people call it horror. To me, it's probably horror adjacent. There's certainly very horror. There's elements in it that are absolutely horror elements. But then there's sort of this strong romantic thread going through it. There's sort of all of these questions about his backstory and what happened to him. There's action scenes. I mean, we have a lot of fights. You know what I mean? So there's a lot of these elements that you know, it's not like
a slasher movie or something like that, where there's here's the monster trying to pick off people one by one. But it, but it absolutely and very by design has horror elements. That was always important.
Now, did you feel shooting at night really helped that ambiance? Like, I felt it did. Like, you didn't have any day scenes, really. Maybe one or two minor ones late in the film.
Well, you know, what's interesting is, we shot a lot at night. But even the day stuff, I shot in a very specific way, and we color graded it to be real kind of dusky.
Yes.
So there is stuff that's shot in the daytime, but when you look at it, there's a timelessness to it. For the most part, I tried to avoid direct sunlight. There's a lot of indirect, really soft light, which, by the way, again, nature helped us because it was snowy and overcast all the time, which really helped with that look. And it was also about, if there was sun, shooting in shadowy areas to give it a very specific kind of look. It's not, which by the way is one of the benefits in shooting in a place like Chicago, and frankly, a benefit in a place like Toronto too versus like LA, right? You shoot in LA and you get sun, right? It is a bright, sunny day every day. In fact, you can see that on a show like X-Files, right? Like X-Files started in Vancouver, and Vancouver has a real nice overcast look. And then the actors were like, we don't want to shoot in Vancouver anymore. We want to move back to LA. And you could look at the latter seasons, and it looks different. The series just totally looks different because all of a sudden you have this direct Southern California sun, which just doesn't look the same. I mean, the world looks and feels different. So we had this lovely indirect soft light, and then in the color correction, we, made everything very dark and shadowy, and it's a very tinted movie, so parts of it are blue or orange or green. I was playing a lot with colors and color grade.
I think you were playing a lot with sound, too, in this film. I got to give your full handout to the sound mixing. I was very impressed with your sound mixing. So you must have guys spend a lot of time sound. And I'm not talking sound editing. I'm talking sound mixing. You guys mix this heavily. I think you spend more time mixing this than you did shooting it, I would argue.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, like the sound design on it. So we had, I'm a professor at Columbia College Chicago, and so when we were going into the sound edit, Diego Trejo, who unfortunately passed away last year, but he was the sound designer and mixer, and also teaches, and so he brought some students on board to help with Foley and things. So there's a lot of Foley, but there's a lot of just design elements throughout. Mm-hmm. So there's music, but then there's also a lot happening in the design. It's a very dense sounding film, or at least in places it's dense. There's other places, obviously, where you have to let it breathe or the audience couldn't take it. But there's a lot of work and sort of thought and sort of, a lot of people work in the sound.
I sounded so clean, though, for an indie. I was quite impressed with the sound. That's one of the things I want to bring to you guys, that your sound department's one of the best I've heard in an indie in a long time.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, we had the ADR parts of it. There are parts of it that, when you shoot on location, for whatever reason, that, the sound is the issue. So we had a fair amount of ADR. But what's interesting is, so anywhere that there was sort of an issue, we tried ADRing it. And then when we got into sort of the mix and further in the process, we discovered that there were some places where we felt the performance suffered as a result of the ADR, like we couldn't quite get there, right? In spite of, we're working with the actors and we're spending time on this, we couldn't quite get there. So there's some places where we went back to the production sound and just cleaned it up the best we possibly could and added sound design and things around it. So whatever the imperfection was that was bugging us, just didn't bug us anymore. Because obviously the performance is first. The performance has to be there. I think that's one of the most important things always.
Now,
thank you.
Your main character does have a career at the beginning of the film. He's a UFC fighter, this and that.
Right.
And then he becomes a homeless man. I don't think I'm ruining anything. That's pretty much stage
right.
the first
time. Right, you find it in like 4 minutes into the film.
So. Yeah. did you like see a homeless man or think maybe that's what started this whole idea? Like, what started the ball rolling? Because, it's a very condensed film. And it feels you're very driven in the story you're telling. Like, I don't see any breaks. I think you have a plan. You know where you right. want to go. And I like how you roll it out very slowly. Like, right. you let me think sure. something, and you never take away what I'm thinking, which I like. And then you right. kind of just add to it, and you're like, okay, we're going to go this way. And we're going to keep the main story, but we're going to take a little slight turn for a few scenes. And then you right. come right back to it. I really like that. So where did that come from, that concept?
Well, the initial idea for sort of Hunter's arc, let me try to figure out how to talk about this without spoilers, because there's sort of some spoilers involved. But, you know, if you think about where Hunter – see, this will just tease it so people have to go and watch it on, you know, all the places there to watch it. Where, if you think about where Hunter ends the film, conceptually the idea was – if you really had a person, say, making the career choices that he makes by the end of the film, that person just couldn't live a normal life,
right?
Right? In this case, he's a homeless person, right? Like, that sort of helps him in that way. I mean, frankly, even if you think about, not that he's a superhero exactly, but you know, like a superhero or whatever, like if you have that kind of lifestyle, it'd be very hard to live a normal life. And in his case, you know, he has this tragic backstory that has caused him to have PTSD, has, you know, he's ended up on the street. It gives him somewhere to go. And it's also, you know, I don't think we've seen a character like this before. I don't think there's been a character exactly like Hunter before in terms of, you know, being a person out on the street, you know, the closest you have is maybe – again, being spoiler-free, maybe somebody like the Punisher. Again, sort of thinking about where he lands. Although the Punisher is quite different in a lot of ways.
Oh, absolutely.
But you know, Hunter, for most of the film, just has absolutely nothing, right? Like, other than sort of his will, you know, to figure out what's going on, is that the ability to sort of pick himself back up. But even that, if you look at where he is at the start of the film, things are not good for Hunter, right? He's living in a state of sort of perpetual fear, and that's a big sort of piece of the arc of the story for him.
But I think you solve that problem throughout your film. You do explain yeah. why Hunter has an issue, and we do find out, which I do like, but we'll get into that. I'm going to try to – there's a scene near the end of the film that I think really helps us out, and you give it to us, and then boom, you give us the final third of the film.
Right.
And I think that works well, because then everything makes sense.
Yes. Yes, we do. The film intentionally raises a lot of mystery and questions and sort of suspense and all of those things, but I hope we at least in a satisfying way answer most of them. I mean, there's probably a couple intentional loose threads at the end, but, you know, the main sort of dramatic questions are more or less answered, right?
Okay, so you're an independent filmmaker shooting in Chicago. You have a UFC fighting ring at the beginning. You have a locker room. How'd you find those?
Okay, so again, going back to this is, you know, indie filmmaking, how do we do things on a shoestring?
Yeah, of course. That's what we're here for.
Of course. So in this case, the cage that he's fighting in is in a gym. And not like a... not like a, you know, not like a ring. Like, this is a gym. Like, 10 feet away from that are exercise machines. So we just filled it with smoke, right? We just filled the place with so much smoke and lit it really dark, and we shot with all of our extras, which, by the way, our extras by the end of the night were 100% our crew. You know, we started out, you know, when you can't pay for extras, everyone's like, yeah, I'll come be in your movie, and then they show up, and they're like, this is the most boring thing. Why am I here? Right. And so by the end of the night, everyone's left. So it's literally, okay, there's the first AD and there's the costume designer. But you know, we really packed the frame. I shot with a lot of telephoto lenses and, you know, it makes it feel like there's more people in there than there are. And also the fact that the place is full of smoke and I'm not lit, right? Everything is allowed to go to darkness in the deep background. Means you can't see the fact that there's, you know, like a Stairmaster 5 feet away from the cage right there. So it was in Evanston. We found it was all of that stuff was shot in one overnight. We shot the dialogue scene in the locker room, which, by the way, was just on the other side of the wall from the cage. And then the three fights. It was three fight scenes and a dialogue scene in one overnight. So it was a lot. People, but you know, like Jason Kellerman, who plays Hunter, it was the last night of principal photography. I knew that we had to sort of work our way up. You know, like the crew has to be like a well-oiled machine to be able to pull something like that off. And by the end of the night, on the last fight, you know, he had been literally in the ring getting tossed. You know, it's stage combat, but still, they're really like tossing each other around and stuff. You know, he came up to me. He said, "David, I got two more takes." And I said, "Okay, we're doing two more takes." You know, that's how it, and he'd been training and all of this stuff. But, you know, at some point, that's how many more takes he had. And then, okay, well, we'll put one of the cameras there, one of the cameras there. We shot all of that with three cameras. It was the only scenes we shot with three cameras. Mostly we just had two, or sometimes one, but mostly two.
I could tell you had no extras because you really cheat on your shot. You're very close to the action a lot of the time. I'm like, he's cheating. There ain't nobody here. And I thought that was great.
But well, when I'm shooting through people, you know, like there's two people in the foreground. And
yes, I was laughing, but I just watch too many films, so I notice these things in indie film. I think if you were just putting it on, you wouldn't notice. But I'm looking for things to talk about, so I'm like, I see that. I'm going to let that go.
Well, you know, you do what you got to do.
Now, do you like UFC, or is this something you thought would work well for the film?
Well, you know, the concept, so it's a couple things. One is that Jason, who played Hunter and was the screenwriter, actually has a background in amateur MMA. So he actually had an MMA background. He knows Krav Maga and had done it on this, you know, not the pro level, but like sort of the pro-am, you know, like almost but not quite, and had done that for years. So he had this as a background. And so thinking in terms of, you know, what's Hunter's superpower in a sense? You know, what is it he's bringing to the table? That's sort of what he brings to the table. You know, he has this persistence. He's able to sort of fit in and be almost invisible because he's homeless. And he knows Krav Maga, right? He's a good fighter. Although all of those things also cause him all kinds of challenges. And, you know, he's just filled with rage. And, you know, Hunter has a lot of psychological problems.
Absolutely. Research into the help for the homeless and homeless shelters and homeless in general. How much research did you do into that?
We did a fair amount of research, actually. So, again, Jason spent, I think, something like 4 months volunteering at a soup kitchen.
Okay.
And, in fact, it's interesting because when we ended up scouting out locations for the Dittmar house, you know, the homeless shelter he ends up at, and we looked at a bunch of different places. The place we ended up finding, and we didn't even tell him this ahead of time, was the shelter that he had volunteered at. So we're like, okay, so we found this great place. It's actually a real homeless shelter, you know, blah, 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 blah. And then he's like, wait, what? You found which one? Oh, my God, that's where I – so it was sort of very authentic then through his experience. So we did that kind of research, and then some other research that I ended up doing was that my sister, Leslie, is actually a psychiatrist, and I talked to her a lot about working with homeless people sort of from her perspective, you know, because Danny is a you know, social worker that he works with, and I wanted to make sure we got that right. Both from the sense of, you know, what does a therapist who's working with homeless people look like? How do they act? You know, but also getting some sense of the psychology of Hunter's character, making sure that we're sort of not getting that wildly wrong. And I think we did a pretty good job.
I think you did a great job. At one scene, Hunter is hungry. He keeps talking about food over and over again, and you finally feed him. Now, my question is, how long did he have to starve himself to eat the food that fast? Because he is whipping through that food. He looked like this guy must be hungry. If he had just eaten, there was no way he could have done that.
Well, you know, he ate a lot of food. You know, like, that's the whole challenge with any acting scene where you have, you know, where you have an actor and they're eating food is, you know, you have multiple takes. You know, there's a scene where he eats a Twinkie.
Yes.
And somewhere around take number 9, he's like, I can't eat any more of these. Ah. I just can't. I can't do this anymore. And I'm like, can you just shove it in your mouth? Can you just kind of, you know, chew them, and then just spit it out. We'll get you a bucket. So the take's in there, actually. He's not actually swallowing. He's so, because he couldn't. He was going to throw up. Like, a human being can only eat so many Twinkies. And the same is true in the scene where he gets fed at the shelter. You know, we're doing a lot of takes. At some point, he's just got to eat a lot of food.
He's just shoveling it, though. I'm
in the beginning.
That's got to be an early take, because he looked hungry. The hair and beard looked real to me.
Yes.
Is it real?
So I'll say this. There was two scenes where it was fake, and I won't ever tell you which ones. I'm not going to tell you, but there are two scenes in the film. So what we had to do is, because we knew we wanted, man, you know, yes, we had a makeup person, but like a fake beard in a close-up requires a lot of time and effort, and it's really hard to pull that off. That was just real. He just grew out the beard and grew out the hair for, you know, like a year or something. And the whole shooting schedule was based around when he shaved. The entire thing was, all right, he's got to shave right here. So, again, if you're interested, the very last thing he shot before he shaved is where he showers. That tiny little scene of him showering was like, I just got to get this last thing. And then he shaved. And so then the rest of the schedule. So what that meant was there's a couple places where there's scenes in a single location, like the bridge, for example, where he's both with and without a beard. We had to shoot those on separate days.
Of course.
Just as a result, you know, like a week apart or something like that, as a result of that. But yeah, the whole schedule. And when he shaved, I had to go after everything. Is every solitary thing I could possibly need to
get. So. Yeah. You can plead the fifth on the next question because I think I know the answer. We have some scenes on the Chicago subway and inside the Chicago subway. The camera, I presume, may or not have got left on by accident.
Green screen. It was really good green screen.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah, we might, you know, we might have gone gorilla a little bit there.
Okay.
Here and there.
But who knows, right? We don't know. Could have been green screen.
I'm pretty sure. Yeah, you know, we were permitted for almost everything for the whole shoot. Like we really did have. Although, and by the way, the fact that it's really difficult and expensive to shoot on the trains meant that there were some places where we got permitted but had to cheat. So, for example, there's scenes where he's sitting out in front of like the turnstiles. Of an L stop, right, of the train stop. So if we wanted to be inside those turnstiles and set up, we would have to get permission from the Chicago Transit Authority, right? But outside is the sidewalk, which is owned by the city and is just a cheap permit. So you can shoot out in front of the bus stop or the train station all you want, as long as, you know, I would have had to get a different permit and start to pay cops and things if we wanted to, you know, stop traffic or whatever. There, but I could shoot outside the L stop all day long without any issues.
Well, that's good. Now, you have a couple scenes with some blood in it.
Yes.
And they're very quick edits. And I think, is it CGI or is it real blood? Because I couldn't tell you there were such quick edits you did on both of them.
Oh, good.
One, I'm sure, is a blood pack, I would argue, but I don't want to talk about it out here because I kind of ruined something.
So I would say, again, try not to spoil anything. We did have, so his flashbacks and things have a lot of blood in them.
Yes.
But again, that's like three frames of something. As far as sort of, you know, blood, say, squirting out of the thing, I think we actually only did that practically once.
Okay, that's what I thought.
And the others are all visual effects.
That's what I figured. Just by the way it looked, I would say it was a visual effect.
I think they look real authentic, though. Right?
They did. Because
none of them were generated. So none of them are actually CGI. They were all composites of actual things.
Okay.
So, So they were real things like squirting out or something.
Yeah, because I'm kind of picky on the edit. I'm like, he's editing this funny. Because I could tell I wasn't sure on the edit. This just didn't look.
Oh, actually, for me, the reason I was cutting them fast wasn't that they didn't look good. Because actually, I think most of them were great. It was that I think the audience's imagination is a far more interesting place to have that live.
I agree.
I think especially when it comes to blood, the human reaction to blood is so strong that when you have a lot of it, it loses its power very fast. Yeah. Right? It's like, okay, the beginning of it, and then by the, you know, like, I don't know, Suspiria or something. Not the bad mouth Suspiria, because Suspiria is a beautiful film, but at some point it's like, okay, and another glass shard through an eyeball. You know, like, you know what I mean? Like, at some point, the audience gets kind of dulled to the intensity of what they're watching. And I actually feel like if you take me up to that moment and suggest it or give me a little bit of it, or, you know, as opposed to here's all the blood and gore, it's like, well, yes, there is, but it's mostly in your head. I think that's so much. It's like reading a horror book or something like that. Like, that's where your imagination is better than what I can do.
I'm just going to make a quick comment on your Suspiria. Suspiria is one of those films you know it's building to that. Going to be an orgy of blood coming any minute. You don't know when it's coming, but you know it's coming.
Right.
And I would argue you do have that in your film near the end. We have a little bit of an orgy of blood.
A little bit. Yeah, there's some blood.
Yeah. I'm leaving it at that.
Although I think the film implies blood more than it shows it.
Yeah,
I mean, there's absolutely, you know, the very end of the, you know, in a sense, like, I know we're about to go to the credits or whatever, so, it's, you know, you got to end on a strong note or whatever.
Oh, absolutely. So, let's go. Okay, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, so I'm showing more, but it's still, you know, I could point to dozens of films that do a lot more than that, and to me, it either creates revulsion, which is not what I was going for, laughs, right, because gore can absolutely turn into laughs. Or you just become kind of dulled to it, right? I don't know. I think you can. I really like implying things like that much more than I like showing them.
I gotta say, how did you evolve your chase scene? I mean, I really like the way you did it on a limited budget.
So we did a few different chase scenes, right? We did some chase scenes with bikes.
The bike one I'm referring to specifically.
So the bike stuff. So, you know, for me, the only way you can properly shoot a chase scene is with a moving camera, right? Like, you have to be, you know, I just can't put it on sticks and be, like, panning as camera, you know, like, that's just death, really. So, almost all of that is shot out of a moving car. So, and often with me hanging out of a window.
I was wondering that.
Yeah. So I, you know, like the climactic, you know, the one, I don't want to give away too much, but you know, like the big one with all, you know, on the bridge, let's say.
That's the end one. Yes.
Yeah. And then with the bikes and things. So, that's me hanging. So I operated throughout. You know, like we had two cameras and the cinematographer was operating one of them and I was operating the other. And so, you know, I'm hanging out the window of a car. Any ones that I'm looking directly onto the face of the actors as they're running towards me, I was shooting out the hatchback of my car.
Okay.
So I was on the pit, and I just had the you know, like the back hatchback up that I'm holding up with my foot. and somebody driving the car probably too fast, because, again, everything has to be at full speed. If people aren't really running, it looks fake.
Oh, I agree.
You know, some people are kind of running. They have to be running. So, you know, at that kind of speed, the hatchback's going to close itself. So I'd have to hold up my feet and then, like, hold the camera between my legs to get the shots. But, you know, it gives it a real energy.
Okay, I'm going to have to beat around the bush here, but you'll know what I'm talking about. We're right near the end. The very big climax. Our lead stumbles onto something. It's a room full of things. How long did it take you to set that up?
Oh, that's a good question.
Because you know what I'm talking about. I'm trying to be vague as I can.
Yes, without spoiling the entire sort of film. So that room, we were shooting in that building. So there was this old abandoned is the wrong word, empty, like not being used warehouse, right? Like, I mean, it was owned by somebody. So a big chunk, you know, we were in there almost a week shooting a lot of different things in there. And so we were in this warehouse, and so that room was a space in that warehouse. So, you know, like where all the fights are with the, you know, that room, the columns, like that's all the same building. So we were already in that building. So I think they were setting up the day before and then finished up the morning of. So probably a day and a half. No, a day and a little bit.
It looks like you spent a lot of time in that room.
Yes.
It looks like you shot different angles. Because just even in your fight choreography, I could see different shots there.
Yes. Yeah, we shot in that room for 3 days, two or three days. I can't remember.
I could see exactly.
Something like that. You know, Nick Searcy, it overlapped when we had Nick Searcy because we were – you know, because Nick was in that room, but we also shot him like the day before we were on location with him. So I'm trying to remember. I think we were maybe two and a half days, something like that. I'm not sure it was 3 days. I don't think it was as long as 3 days.
You have lots of fighting in this film, I would say. Lots of fight scenes. Doesn't matter. How much did you spend on your fight choreography? Like working on it? Like, did you go ahead of time? Or did Jason just say, tell them the day, an hour before, let's do this, is what we're going to do?
That's a great question. So, Bo was our fight choreographer, and I would say different fights had different amounts of preparation. For most of the fights, Bo met with the fighters ahead of time and had at least one rehearsal blocking session with them that then he would tape or, you know, Skype me in or whatever, and I'd look and give thoughts and notes and stuff like that. And it would also allow me to start thinking about coverage and how I want to shoot them. So that was most of them. I know that when we actually did the fights, like the MMA fights, all of the fighters that Hunter was fighting are actual MMA fighters, right? So all three of them. In fact, the third one is a pretty well-known UFC guy. And so those were actually mostly worked out on the day, believe it or not, because we didn't really have access to them ahead of time. But these are people who fight all the time.
Yeah, so they know what they're doing.
They know what they're doing, and then they're able to sort of keep doing it over and over in spite of, again, it's, you know, I mean, Jason got slammed around so much, and, you know, he's lucky he didn't get a concussion. I think he was getting a little dizzy there by the end.
Okay. I have two last questions, and then we'll get to fun questions.
All right.
We're near the end of the film, very end of the film. We have a big scene. Lots of cars involved and people involved, and something goes into the water. I presume that was a dummy. It looks like it hit pretty hard, but I could be wrong. Also, did you have a permit for that shot?
Great question. So we were permitted to shoot on the bridge. In fact, we had – That was one of the most expensive, most complicated. In fact, that night was easily our most expensive, most complicated night because we had to get a police presence there. We shut down the bridge. You know, it's one of the bridges in downtown Chicago, and like it was a thing. I'm so excited that you thought that a dummy hit the water. It's all visual effects.
Really?
Yes. Nothing fell off.
I rewound it twice going, I'm not sure. Yes. I'm going to go with a dummy, but I don't know.
So if you're interested, I'll tell you how we did it. So
I'd love to. Yes.
So we shot, like, on the day on location. Most of that scene is just practical, right? Like, you know, like all of the dialogue, you know, like all the action and the chase and like, all of that stuff is just shot as practical stuff. But as far as the actual jumping off the bridge part, that involved, so we shot plates on the day, and then we shot green screen,
okay.
And then there's a stock shot in there. So there's a piece of stock that is color corrected very differently from how it looks, and yeah, the rest of it's all visual effects.
Good work, then. I was not sure.
That's just what I want to hear.
The only thing, this is the only, I wasn't sure because when he hit the water, see, when the splash happens.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The only thing I wasn't sure, I'm like, I don't know. That's the only part I would have argued going, could be either way. That's the part that was throwing me off.
Oh, I'm so excited. No, that's just what I want to hear.
Okay, good.
but part of it, too, is about the speed of it. You know, you're trying to at least suggest real time there. Although, really, if somebody jumped off a bridge, the thing would be like 4 frames long, right? Like,
no, I understand. No.
But it's relatively fast because it's not like, you know, you have the Matrix budget, then you can slow everything down to bullet time. And, you know, when you have less of a budget, we can still do things, but the longer that they're up there, the more you can see, you know, the bubble gum and scotch tape that's sort of holding it all together, you know. When something's 11 frames long, I can get away with stuff that if it was, like, up there for 4 or 5 seconds, I could just never get there.
This might be a little bit of a spoiler, but I'm going to have to ask anyway. Is there a sequel?
That's certainly the intention. I mean, that was always the intention, is okay. that there's some ways in which this is an origin story by design, sort of constructed by design. So Jason is actually written sort of an outline for how to tell 5 seasons of a series out of this.
I could see that, actually.
So we could potentially do it that way. We potentially could do another feature or something like that. But there's absolutely room to sort of jump off of the story and keep telling the story. I think it's really compelling. I think the world that we constructed is interesting. People keep telling me they're interested in it. So I'd love to tell more stories.
I would love to see your story or your next one with a bigger budget. I think that would help you guys out immensely.
Oh, it would be great.
And I really felt you guys were constrained by your budget at times. And it upset me because I could see where you were going and where you wanted to go. But because your budget wouldn't allow you, you couldn't go there. And it was after you see the film, you'll understand what I'm saying. You know what I'm saying. I felt bad for you guys. I'm like,
well, you know,
see what they want to do, but you can't do it. But I think the film works because of that.
Well, you know, for artists, there's always constraints, you know, like there's always things you can do and things you can't do. In this case, I think, it would always be nice to have more resources and things like that. But I think being kind of lean forced us to make a lot of creative sort of decisions and sort of problem solving that I think ended up making the movie feel really distinctive as a result of that.
I have to agree. Okay, more on to fun questions. Everybody's favorite prep part of the show.
All right.
Your favorite film and why?
My favorite film? I think my favorite film... Oh, that's tough because I have a bunch of favorite films.
Go ahead, give me a few.
All right. So if I was going to give you my list, and this is a list... Most of these are films that have been favorites for a long time. I love Citizen Kane. I think Citizen Kane is an unbelievable work of art. The first time I saw it, I just couldn't believe it. I was like, oh my God, this is so good. So I love Citizen Kane. I love Blade Runner. I love Fight Club.
I see where you're going. It's all auteurs. You got a very sense of style in filmmaking in all those films. None of them look the same.
They're all very distinctive.
Nothing looks like them. Kane doesn't look like anything else. Blade Runner doesn't look like anything else. Fight Club does not look like anything else.
Right. No, I absolutely agree. I think there is something to be said for, you know, finding your own style. You know, I don't think my films look like any of those films, right? You know, like,
no.
I think of the filmmakers that I love. Like, when I first started making films, I remember early on when I was in film school, somebody looking at one of my very first films and saying, wow, this looks just like Orson Welles. And at the time, I took it as a compliment. But now I'm like, well, I haven't digested Orson Welles enough. Because, you know, if it's looking like Orson Welles to you, it shouldn't be looking like Orson Welles. It should look like David Tarleton. You know, to me, there's all these lessons to be learned from different filmmakers. And absolutely, some of that is the sense of style, right? Like, how do you make a film that looks and feels distinct? And the look and feel of it is also integral to the story you're telling, right? Like, they have to be, you know, form follows function. It can't just be, I'm going to do this cool style because it, you know, think about something like The Matrix, right? The Matrix wasn't green because being green is cool. The Matrix was green because they're inside a friggin' computer simulation, and the green is to suggest, like, that the computer's got it a little wrong, and it's in your, like, green, you know, monochrome monitors and things like that. You know, the techno music is because they're playing a friggin' video game, right? It's like, it's like a 90s fighting game, right? The slow motion bullet time is because it's a friggin' video game. You know, like, that's all that made sense. And then people are like, oh, that style's really cool. Let's just rip that off. Yeah, but it doesn't make any sense in your movie. Why is your movie green? Or even like the way the fights look in like the Bourne movies, right? They're really disorienting because the dude is disoriented.
Correct.
The character, it's confusing because the character has amnesia,
yep.
Right? It doesn't make sense if you're telling a story that the character's not disoriented. Like in Hunter's disoriented. He's got PTSD. So the fact that there's a chaoticness and a disorientation to parts of the film is because the character is chaotic and disoriented and confused about what's real and not. And the form of the film has to reflect that, you know? So to me, that's some of the lessons I hopefully learned, not just, yeah, shoot everything, you know, like Stanley Kubrick in a single point perspective or something.
Kat, this is your big chance to give a shout out to your caterer. Your favorite pizza place and why?
Well, I'm in Chicago.
That's why I'm asking.
I probably Giordano's. I really like Giordano's. I also like Lou Malnati's. Both of them deliver to my house, so you know it's hard to turn either of them down because they're both very good. And so I'm in Chicago, but you know most people here don't eat the Chicago deep dish every day, right? Like the deep dish is good, but I would die. My heart would stop because it's like 2 inches thick of cheese. I just eat a block of cheese.
It's so like, good, but yeah.
It's so good, but it's, you know, like most Chicagoans, I tend to eat the thinner crust, but, the deep dish is really good for special occasions.
I don't know if you're a sports fan or not, but I have to ask, the Cubs or the White Sox?
Well, I will acknowledge that I have to stay neutral about these things. You know, I'm not originally from Chicago, and I do feel like people who are originally from here, it's like an intergenerational, it's like in Ireland, the Protestants versus the Catholics or something, right? It's like, you know, my father was a Sox fan, so I've got to be a Sox fan. So I intentionally have stayed neutral. I think they're both great.
Fair enough. Well, tell everybody where they can find your film, please.
Sure. So the website is hunterfilmchicago.com, and there are actually links off of that to places you can see it, but you can find it on Amazon and iTunes and Google Play and Redbox and Microsoft and all of the various places that you can find streaming video. It's there. You can also, you know, if you purchase discs, which people still sometimes buy DVDs and things, you can find it on Amazon, Redbox. Apparently, you can find it at Walmart. So.
Oh, cool.
Go out and get Hunter.
Absolutely. Get Hunter. Thank you for your time and have a great evening.
All right. Thanks so much.
Hey, I just want to say thank you for listening to this great interview. We have more on our website at www.extrafeatures.ca. And if you enjoyed it, can you please go to iTunes and leave us an iTunes review and like us on our Facebook page? Thank you.